guardian.co.uk.
Welcome to Film Weekly, I'm Jason Solomons. This week we travel from the bustling streets of West London to the noisy streets of Kinshasa in the Congo, Central Africa. Film Weekly catches up with Adam Deacon, writer, director and star of Another Hood, the first ever British urban comedy. And producers Renaud Barret and Florent de la Tulle tell us the astonishing story behind their documentary Benda Bilili, about a group of disabled Congolese musicians who've gone from sleeping in cardboard boxes to the Cannes Film Festival and the top of the world music charts. Plus, Zan Brooks will be here helping me review some of this week's other releases, including Felicity Jones and Ed Westwick in Chalet Girl and Woody Allen's latest London movie, You Will Meet a Tall Dark Stranger. It's better than a ticket to the 100 metres Olympic final. It's Film Weekly. Five years in the making, Benda Bilili follows a group of street musicians from Kinshasa in the Democratic Republic of Congo as they struggle to record their first album. Four of the group are paraplegics who get around the city in Easy Rider-style customised wheelchairs. The other three are homeless street kids, whose star is Roger Landau, a teenage prodigy who plays a homemade single-string guitar made out of a tin can and a bit of a chair. It's an astonishing story, one that music and film producers Renaud Barret and Florent de la Tulle are responsible for bringing to our ears and our eyes. You discovered this band, you've brought them from Kinshasa, from the streets of Kinshasa, and here they are playing at the Union Chapel in the UK. You've toured with them at Glastonbury and you've been to Copenhagen, all around festivals in France. How do you feel when you're sort of in charge of this group of remarkable people?
I guess we feel like more like a happy family, because we've got the feeling in that we have accomplished something together. And well, it's not more like we drove them around the world. I mean, I could, you know, do it. We could say the opposite, like they drove us around the world. We went to Cannes, we went to the States, we went everywhere thanks to them. So I mean, it's like more symbiotic kind of relationship that, between them and us.
Good. I wanted to mention that, Renaud. I'm glad you said that, because when you're watching the documentary, it's an interesting film, because it's often documentary role is to kind of stand back and not get involved. But you clearly did get involved in their life.
In 2004, we met the little prodigy Roger, the child with a one-string instrument. But it was completely by chance that we came across him, and then he disappeared, and he just showed up, as you can see in the movie, just showed up like 1 year and a half later, 15 days before the first recording of the band. And it was again quite by chance, but is there any chance in Kinshasa? We don't know.
What interests me, because I know you come from the music sort of area in terms of this. You produced the album Très Très Fort for them.
We were not music producers. We became music producers in Kinshasa, as we became filmmakers too.
Right.
So that city made us. You know, it's everything happened very quite. So
did you have a model of filmmaking in your head? Did you think, well, this is how you do a documentary? Did you know of any other documentaries that you wanted to make a film in the manner of?
We had seen some beautiful documentary and helped us to make a documentary. So
which ones?
The name is
Shape of the Moon.
Shape of the Moon and some documentary from Wiseman.
It's Fred Wiseman.
Plus Dig. Plus also the documentary Dig about the Brian Johnstone massacre.
Yes, music. And interestingly, your film, there's a bit where it starts, where Benda Bilili meet, and I think it's called Sonas Roundabout.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I was watching the documentary When We Were Kings by Leon Gast about the rumble in the jungle, also in Kinshasa, and then the music documentary after that, Soul Power.
Yeah, Soul Power.
And I'm sure there's a bit in that where he finds a group who are playing in that spot. Is this a place where musicians gather?
No. It's like it's right in the middle of the financial, between brackets, center of Kinshasa. They are just basically performing here because that's where they do their little businesses, such as selling cigarettes and whiskeys at late at night. And well, that's how we met them. I mean, like, the first sequence of the movie is more about the true atmosphere of how we met them, but it was not that very day.
Absolutely. I mean, it isn't incredible then, I suppose. you think, well, there's a story here, there's also music here, and then you follow them back to the centre where they live, the sort of shanty town, I suppose it is, which is an extraordinary place.
Yeah, for but in fact, if I may, because we didn't intend to do a movie first. It was just the idea was to record an album. So, like, we started to film them, but it was on a daily basis because we were working with them. But we didn't say to ourselves, oh, we got a movie. It was not the case. We were already in the production of another movie, and we just fell in love with their music. Mm. Basically, that was it. And it's only after 2 years and a half when the Belgian producer came in, and Vincent Kenis, and the album started to really be recorded, and the press started to began to speak about the band, that we realized that maybe this band was going to tour the world, and it was at that moment that we decided that we could do a movie. Depuis le loté, wana papa na liste papa Ricky. Comment on balie? Bas les cacahuètes ceux qui n'aiment. Ah wa bazar de tout bako mon enfant voilà mieux photo. Mon voilà la petite. And we started to look back on our rushes, and we realized that we had like the film from the inside, the slow rise of a band of complete outcasts
and characters as well. I mean, if you were if you were in Hollywood and you were pitching the movie, you know, which you know it's a good idea. Let's start it right now because I mean, you know, you can kind of, that Jamie Foxx, he can play the main guy.
Yeah, sure.
And everyone would love to play these guys. There's some amazing stuff. The football match. Mm. Where they're just kind of crawling on like beetles in the
you
sand.
Have to, you have to see on the I mean how the world of the disability in Kinshasa is so powerful and strong because they haven't been ever helped a bit from the very beginning. Mm. So they kind of developed a strength that we're not very familiar with in Europe, you know, because they're living just like regular people from the street. There's no really difference. So they're very strong.
Very
they do
strong.
Whatever people do and to survive, and they're very good at survival.
They also don't seem particularly. There's no self kind of pity in
Never.
A way, even though they sing about their situation a lot in their lyrics. Which I think is one of the strengths of the music is that you can kind of feel this kind of defiance in the song. I mean, one of the songs is, you know, it's never too late in life. Il n'est jamais trop tard dans la vie. You know, and you can feel this kind of opportunity coming up. They're almost like little businessmen as well because, you know, they know this is an opportunity for them and they're grabbing at it. It's
and
very exciting visually to see. And I think one of the best scenes in the film is something you couldn't make up, I think, is when they go to the first festival and they start playing and they get an early afternoon slot and it's like, it must be 2 o'clock and everyone's drunk or whatever. No one's heard of this kind of group stuff. And then three people and a dog are like listening. And then by the end, the whole crowd is gathered.
Yes,
I mean, if that was the Hollywood film, we'd kind of conduct that with a big kind of crowd scene, but that obviously just happened for you.
That was the happy ending, right?
Yeah.
So, when we were filming that particular concert, you have to imagine that we came directly from Kinshasa. And like 5 days before that, we were not even sure to get the visa. So it was just a miracle, and we took the band. They were, you know, sleeping on cardboards in the street, and they hopped in the truck, went to the airport, and then 3 days later we're on the festival.
Yeah. I mentioned that some documentaries don't get involved, you know, they just kind of observe. And now you say you're like a family and you're traveling with them and helping them as well. But now they're stars, presumably. In Kinshasa, these are kind of some of the most famous people since Muhammad Ali visited. You know, this is an extraordinary story for them. How are they coping with the increased fame, perhaps the increased money? And where does your responsibility as their producers lie?
We feel no responsibility towards that. Would I feel any responsibility for a European band getting rich? I mean, you know, it's like the same. They're all wise guys. They know how to cope with their new lives, you know. So we don't very much interfere in what they're
doing.
But
they all had deals, the contracts were all good.
Yeah, everything is pretty clean on the very beginning. That was our main concern.
It was one of the first scenes, wasn't it? They got some money from you to even film them, didn't they? Talking about the money. Yeah,
yeah,
not
exactly.
Stupid, as you say.
but to answer your first question about their new condition in Kinshasa, they're not like the superstars, you know, because I would say that they're the bad ambassadors for the country. Because in the movie, what we see means like when you're a disabled guy, I mean, you just have to sort things out yourself. Mm. And also you see all this population of street kids pushing their chairs means that these children are not going to school, in fact. So all these different aspects that you see in the background of the movie, which are not the foreground, right? It's like the background, is something that made the authorities a bit uncomfortable with the band. And so they're not going to be rocketing the stardom in Kinshasa anyway. But it's more like they have to hide a bit. They can't rehearse in the zoo anymore, for instance. They don't go to the Sonas roundabout as they did before. Mm. Because it's very, and there is a very overwhelming pressure around them.
Well, they've responded very well.
They haven't changed a bit.
What I like about your any documentary is that there's always an after story in reality, and that yours is continuing after the end of the film. Mm. It's not the last we're going to hear of Ben Dembélé, Renaud Barré, Florent de la Tulipe. Merci beaucoup. Thank you very much for bringing not only yourselves to our studio, but to Ben Dembélé, to London, and the rest of the world as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ben Dembélé goes on nationwide release here in the UK from Friday the 18th of March. Their album Très Très Fort is currently number one in the world music charts, and the band themselves are back in the UK for concerts in May. Now, music to my ears of a different kind as Zan Brooks ambles in to discuss the week's releases. Zan, have you seen Ben Dembélé?
I did see it.
Yeah. Were you uplifted?
I was uplifted, and it's a great portrait of that world, a world that you don't really know.
What, disabled musicians?
Disabled musicians
in
Kinshasa,
yeah.
Running around the zoo and playing football on the sand, where they kind of run around on their elbows and knees.
Fast,
absolutely.
I love
they
the train.
Beat me.
I love all the stuff on the train as well. That's where you get that kind of
glimpse.
Yeah,
the people
of the world.
Hanging off the edge. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Oh, good. I'm glad you liked it. I didn't know if it was your sort of thing.
No, but then it is. If it's I don't think it was either, but it
no,
is.
No, and if it's not your sort of thing, then you are hard of heart, I believe. But you like the music? You got
the music was very good.
Good.
I like the milk can.
Good. Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Ben Dembélé, go see and buy the album as well while you're at it. But Zan, we shall get back to the business at hand of some of the week's other releases. We're going to look at Chalet Girl, You Will Meet a Tall Dark Stranger, Submarine. You can tell me about The Lincoln Lawyer, and we must mention Ken Loach's Root Irish as well. But let's start with Chalet Girl, which stars the winsome Felicity Jones and the handsome Ed Westwick. She plays a champion skateboarder who's down on her luck and decides to take flight by looking after some posh people in St. Anton.
Like that, she became a swan.
So I used to be an ugly duckling then?
Someone needs to learn how to take a compliment.
It's a shoelace.
It's a bow tie.
No, it's a shoelace knot. Come here.
I think you'd be the kind of girl who knew how to tie a bow tie.
Here's me thinking you were the kind of boy who would. Big night for you then. There. License to kill.
Or be killed.
Felicity Jones doing up Ed Westwick's bow tie there. You probably don't know who Ed Westwick is,
I don't
do
know, but
he's in
from
Gossip
what
Girl.
I can imagine there's a lot of girls that would like to do up his bow tie.
They would. He's in a film, a thing called Gossip Girl, which is
yes,
on the telly.
Yeah.
You know that.
I haven't seen it, but I've heard it's
no,
very good.
Yes, it's not very good, really. It's
is it not? Okay.
It's like Sex and the City uptown.
Like
I mean, it's all right. You know. But anyway, my wife fancies Ed Westwick. I'm going to tell you that now.
Right.
I don't know why. But she does.
So don't take her to this.
No. Well, I mean, why? Will she not fancy him?
No, she won't fancy you. That's the problem.
Zan, it's a snowmantic comedy.
Is it? I was going to say it's Pygmalion on skis. but either one, I suppose. It's a bit of Pretty Woman in there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's Felicity Jones as a champion skateboarder, as we've said. And I didn't even know there were many of those.
Oh, there are.
Who has given it up because of a tragedy in her past. But You know, I think she can probably show the poshies how it's done by just adapting her skateboarding skills to the slopes.
Do you think so? Do you think that it's so. The same game?
And we obviously don't want to give too much away.
No. You know, when it started, I thought, oh, God, this is awful, you know, by the numbers and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, but...
And then something strange happened. I think Felicity Jones won me over.
Felicity Jones is good. Bill Nighy is always good. Yeah. And there was a weird... lack of pretension to it. It wasn't trying to be anything more than it was. It's absolutely relentlessly cheesy and unapologetically schmaltzy.
Yeah, and there are 100 songs. I mean, every scene is a new montage. I mean, there's her falling over in the snow, playing with Ed Westwick. There's her kind of cleaning the chalet. There's her practicing her snowboarding. I mean, there are at least 55 montages in here.
Yeah, which is incredibly lazy and does a lot of the heavy lifting. And yet there was something sort of shameless and brazen about it that weirdly was oddly charming.
Do you think it's because it's a British romantic comedy, but yet it's in the American model? It's not like Four Weddings and a Funeral, which is entirely British.
Yeah.
It's kind of following that kind of crap 27 dresses, you will, how to win a guy in 10 ski lifts kind of thing.
Maybe it is, and maybe because of that it's got a certain novelty value. I think if we probably see 3 or 4 of these a year, we'll increasingly get sick of it. But for the moment, and really just for the moment, I think probably half an hour from now, I'll think back on this film and realise I did hate it after all. But for the moment, it was okay.
Yeah, no, I think Felicity Jones has goofy charms.
And, yeah, she does.
And I support her in this. So well done, Felicity. Chalet Girl, another romantic roundelay, this time from Woody Allen, somewhat more seasoned in his aspects of the heart. He is back in London for his fourth movie. It's You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger. Here's Naomi Watts being opportuned by her gallery-owning boss, Antonio Banderas.
Listen, I don't know if you are interested, but can I offer you 2 tickets for Lucia di Lammermoor tonight? I mean, my wife just called and she cannot go, so I thought maybe you can take the tickets and go with your husband.
Well, isn't there somebody else you want to ask?
Not in such a short notice, actually.
Oh, geez. Well, tonight's Roy's poker night. Anyway, he's far too antsy to sit through anything.
Maybe you can find some friends to go with. I mean, you mentioned how much you like Donizetti.
I love it. I just never get to go to the opera. Tickets are way too expensive.
Listen, look, take this and I mean, if you don't mind, we could go together. Unless you have other plans this evening.
No, I'm dying to see it.
Really?
I'd love to go.
Great.
Okay.
All right.
We could have had clips then from Anthony Hopkins and Lucy Punch. We could have had many other people in the cast, Josh Brolin and Frida Pinto.
Yeah.
It is the kind of what he does these days. He kind of picks a kind of lot of people in
well, we also could have had clips from any Woody Allen film of the last 15 years.
Yeah, we couldn't have had Annie Hall and Manhattan and
No, but we could have had any of the ones sort of post 1996 or so. Because this is still very much Woody Allen on sort of half speed. It's kind of Woody Allen Muzak, really. It's minor key. It kind of is a little tinkling romantic ensemble comedy. That's not to say it's bad, but it's certainly not to say it's a return to form, which everybody each time in that sort of desperate, hopeful way, there's always that moment where people come out of a Woody Allen film and say, well, it was good, so therefore it's a return to form.
Yeah, because he's quite nice to watch.
He's always nice to watch, and he knows what he's doing. And maybe this is a case of what happens to filmmakers when they hit a certain age. You know, the first part of your career, you're asking questions of yourself and of the world, and then you think, well, this is what I do, I can do it. He cranks out a film a year. Mm. They're never appalling, but by the same token, they are never as good as the early ones.
No, they're not. I actually think this is probably the best of the London ones.
Yeah,
I think
probably
it's better than Cassandra's Dreams, better than Scoop. It's probably better than Match Point. It bears a similarity to Match Point in that it sort of deals with a fairly wealthy kind of section of society. I like the West London locations. He doesn't seem to be trying so hard here. Or I don't know if it's me I'm sort of relaxed into the fact that these are kind of British people speaking British and yet still got a Woody Allen-ish kind of twang
sort
to
of,
it.
You know, East Side New York vibe to it.
Yeah, I mean, they go to the opera. I like that. There's art galleries. And people always said in Match Point, God, he's terrible. He doesn't get London at all. Well, you know, people do go to the opera.
There is that London out there.
Yeah. People do have art galleries in London.
It's got a great performance by Anthony Hopkins, I think.
He's really good in it.
As the sort of the aging husband who takes off with a younger model and is sort of popping the Viagra and saying, just wait a moment, just a few minutes. I just want to admire you.
And there's a lovely line where because he wants to take this younger model who's in a sort of Essex girl called Charmian or Chalmaine.
Yeah.
And she says, I don't want to go to the theatre. It wasn't even scary last time. And he says, well, I think Ibsen meant them to be metaphorical ghosts. That's classic, Woody Allen.
That is very good.
I enjoyed Your Meet Dr. Octopus. There's a kind of darkness to it as well. It's about kind of, you know, love being thwarted and maybe marriage not always working out. But so for some people, it works out. Jimmy Jones is rather charming in it, and Pauline Collins. And I like the kind of spirit world that she channels, even if it is bells rather than...
I think even bad Woody Allen is better than a lot of the stuff out there.
I do too. And that's when I saw this for the second time. Then I saw Chalet Girl. And after 5 minutes, I thought, well, God, Woody Allen knows how to make a movie more than whoever it is that directed Chalet Girl. That said, Chalet Girl will make a lot more money than you will take.
It will. And also, it does, you know, it does still make me nostalgic for the Woody of old.
Yeah, you still pine. There's still something there. I think so. Zan, another filmmaker emerging this week from the shores is Richard Ayoade, better known perhaps from the IT Crowd and Mighty Boosh on television, here making his directorial debut with a coming-of-age tale based on Joe Dunthorne's novel. It's set in a non-specific, but I think 70s, Swansea, and stars Craig Roberts trying to get his end away and also save his parents' marriage.
To us, and a wonderful evening of lovemaking.
Can you just, like, get off my shoulders?
No, I'm just directing you, just... Right, okay, just don't open them, I'll tell you. Stay there.
What now?
Yeah.
Fucking hell, you're a serial killer.
Teenage fumblings in the night in submarine in Swansea. There's a bit of Truffaut going on here.
There's a bit of Truffaut. There's, you know, I guess it is the cliche of all debut films is you're kind of pouring all your influences onto the screen. So there's a lot of French New Wave here. There's a lot of sort of 90s American indie, whether that be Hal Hartley or a little bit later, maybe sort of Wes
there's
Anderson.
A bit of Wes Anderson, Rushmore, Truffaut, Grange Hill.
Yeah, characters in, you know, introduced on freeze frame, lots of voiceover, lots of blank faces, but kind of incidental. Comedy around
doodling.
It.
Doodling.
A lot of doodling in there too. It's a very smart, clever film from a very smart, clever filmmaker.
Yeah, I think he's a very smart, clever filmmaker. I'm not sure. I didn't love this film, which is actually, I'm getting sort of a lot of
aggravation. People do. People really love it.
People really love it. Yeah. I think it reveals him to be a very gentle soul, to be very witty and bright. And I think clearly a very good filmmaker.
Yes,
I'm really looking forward to his next film, which might settle down. I don't like the doodling. I didn't really like the music. I didn't really like the lead, Craig Roberts, actually, which is a bit of a problem given that he's in most of it.
Well, he has to maintain the sort of same expression throughout it all. And that's more of a director's problem than the actor's problem, I guess. That's his call. That's what he's having to do. There is definitely the sense that all the characters here are pieces on a chessboard being sort of moved around, and you never actually feel that they're real people necessarily. And for a film that is about teenage loneliness and awkwardness, it's not very moving.
No, I found it that the carapace of emotion was kind of impenetrable.
Yeah. But for all that, it is a brilliant film. In the way that it arranges these pieces and is totally in control of its medium. But I just wish there was a bit of human warmth in there too.
Yeah, do you know what? I didn't laugh that much either. I kind of smiled quite occasionally, and I thought Sally Hawkins was brilliant and lovely, and Paddy Considine in Night at the World's. But perhaps this week's best wig, though you may tell me a bit later that there is a better wig out there. As the life guru, I really enjoyed Paddy Considine's performance. It is slightly... of another film.
It's another film, perhaps even the summer, My Summer of Love, where he plays a sort of similar character. Paddy Considine's always good value. It's a good film. I would be surprised if people went and thought that they'd wasted their money.
Please, Richard Ayoade, make another film, please, very soon. I'm sure you will. I mentioned Paddy Considine's wig. The film you're about to tell me about is The Lincoln Lawyer. I've only seen a TV advert in which William H. Macy, an actor who I very much like, has, I think, an even bigger wig on than Paddy Considine. Is this true? What is this film about? Is it about a lawyer in a mullet? I don't get it. It stars Matthew McConaughey and lots of Hell's Angels, it seems. Zan, what is The Lincoln Lawyer? Who is the Lincoln Lawyer? Why
is
The Lincoln Lawyer?
Well, this isn't the prequel to Lincoln President. This is instead Matthew McConaughey, not in a rom-com for once, playing a shyster lawyer.
Does he take his shirt off?
He doesn't really take his shirt off,
then,
even.
Then what's the point?
And, you know, your wife as well, presumably, has no interest in seeing this now.
She never fancied him.
That's what she tells you. This is him as shyster lawyer, basically running his business out of the back of his Lincoln town car because he's a bit down on his luck.
Oh, it's that sort of Lincoln.
It is that sort of Lincoln. And he runs across a client who is a real estate mogul played by Ryan Phillippe, who's been accused of beating up a prostitute, but is, of course, innocent. So Matthew McConaughey steps in to kind of make a lot of money and get this guy off. But then, of course, typically with these kind of films, you realise there's maybe a little more to the story than meets the eye.
I was surprised in the credits that the word John Grisham The words John Grisham did not feature.
The words John Grisham don't, but the words Michael Connelly do.
Who, is he the same thing?
He is sort of the same thing, and that you've never seen the two of them in the room at the same time. it's very much cut from that sort of cloth.
I like that sort of cloth. It's a sort of... They don't make much... I mean, there was all the Grisham stuff, which often starred Matthew McConaughey as well, like Time to Kill.
Yeah.
And I sort of miss those adult sort of dramas. They don't really make them anymore.
I guess they don't. They've sort of gone out of fashion a bit. And this is, you know, harking very much back to that sort of 90s school of those kind of films. It's that weird thing where it's at once convoluted and tangled and utterly predictable in that you know when the big reveals are coming. And Matthew McConaughey kind of goes from the sort of the smug lawyer to being sort of deeply shocked and troubled and borderline hysterical. It's sort of L.A. noir, really, and it's L.A. noir light, but it's reasonably well done. I wouldn't say any more about it than that.
Like Lincoln itself, it's kind of...
Well
put together and safe, but nothing
Yeah, and
exciting.
We'll get you there, but, yeah. You know, there's not much to see along the way.
Any more motor metaphors that we can add to
it? Matthew McConaughey breaks down at one point.
Does he?
Yeah.
Excellent.
I think we'll end it there.
I think we'll end there, except...
We'll pull into the parking lot.
We shall park it in a lay-by. We should go down another road now, Zant. It's Ken Loach's latest film, Root Irish, which stars John Bishop, who's a sort of stand-up comedian these days, but wasn't when I first saw this film at Cannes. Now he seems to be everywhere. He plays a returning contractor from Iraq with something terrible happening in the past on that world's most dangerous road, the Root Irish, which leads between the Baghdad airport and downtown Baghdad.
And the Green Zone.
Zant, this is Ken Loach in kind of exciting modern mode.
It is, isn't it? I mean, in the hands of another filmmaker, this would be your big bells and whistles political thriller set in the badlands of Iraq. It's not quite that, and maybe to a fault, it strays towards that and then veers off again.
Yeah.
We're doing a lot of car metaphors here, aren't we?
Yes.
I've really got to stop this. So it never quite adds up. It's not the best film that Loach has done, and it's not the best film that I would have expected Loach to do on this subject. I think Loach is great, and I'm really glad that he's making films about these kind of stories, because somebody has to. But this wasn't quite as honed and precise as it should have been.
That said, there is a waterboarding scene in it, which is actually really quite sort of shocking.
Yeah, absolutely strong, terrifying.
As well. One of the strongest scenes in Ken Loach's oeuvre, actually. But I do feel that there was something missing to his normal kind of deep humanism, actually. I think it was a sort of... I didn't really like anyone in this film.
It's true. And that does count against it. And again, it shouldn't. You should be able to make a film where everybody is a bit grubby. But maybe that's going against Ken Loach's natural instinct, which is to sort of hail people and find the best in people.
Yeah.
And this was working against that.
I agree. Root Irish by Ken Loach, but still a film worth noting, because a Ken Loach film is always worth noting, as is a Woody Allen film. Got two veterans there who are sort of big Cannes Film Festival favourites. For more of Zan's musings on the world of film, go to that treasure trove of filmic jewels, guardian.co.uk/film.
I'd like to meet that Trevor Trove.
Trevor Trove.
OK, what are you doing? Why are you here laying on the floor?
You were meant to start work 10 minutes ago. Meanwhile, you're here sleeping on the floor.
I'm not sleeping, man.
You know, I don't know who you think you are, Kenneth, but I'm not going to have you disrespecting my authority. Now, let's get to work now.
You know what? If you keep messing me around, I promise you...
You know what, yeah? Burn your job, blood.
Sorry?
Man's on big things out here, Ruben. Here we go again. Mr. Kenneth O'Sullivan Fletcher, the next nappy from N Dubs. Somehow I can't see it.
Is that your full name, Blood?
My name is Kay.
Kay Lamesbury.
Shut your mouth, you butter skit. And you see you, Russell, yeah? If you think I'm going to be working here for the rest of my life like you, Blood, you must be mad. I'm gone. I'm on big things, Blood.
Waste man!
You're a flipping waste, people, man. You get me? You lot keep stacking boxes, yeah? While I start stacking dough, you get me?
You're going to become a baker now, are you? Baker.
The sounds of West London there in a new British comedy, Another Hood. In fact, it's the first British urban comedy, or at least the only one I can think of, taking the Hoodie movie another step further after adulthood and kidulthood. Adam Deacon, who's the star of the film, has been acting since he was 12. You might have seen him in The Bill or Casualty or in those aforementioned adulthood and kidulthood movies. But for the first time, he's directing a film and he also wrote it. It is Another Hood, and Adam Deacon joins me in the studio now. Welcome to Film Weekly, Adam. You've just had your premiere last night. That's been quite exciting for you. Is that your first premiere?
It was my first premiere as a director and writer. Yeah. So I guess my film.
It was really your film. Yeah,
it was an amazing night. Very surreal. I don't think it's really sunk in yet, but like exactly kind of what happened last night, but it was just, it was so good to see people's reactions for the first time to the movie. And
Because your film is a comedy, and that's the thing with a comedy, you really never know if it's funny or if it's working until you play it to a big packed house.
That's exactly it. And you know, you make the film, and you just you don't know if it's going to work. You hope it does. And last night was just kind of it showed me, well, okay, people are laughing, so
in the right place. That's it. not at you, with you. You hope. Well, they may have been laughing at you, but whatever. A laugh's a laugh. That's what I'd say.
Yeah.
Adam, we mentioned you're the director, but you're also the star in it. You play Kay. In there. Tell me a bit about your character and what he's doing and where you got the idea for the film and why you came up with this character.
I play a guy called Kenneth that likes to be called Kay. He's deluded. He's that kind of typical kind of kid you might find on a bus, you know, the kid that's at the back playing with ringtones and talking loud and making a scene. And he wants to be something big, but he doesn't really know what it is. He wants to just be respected on the streets. And so, you know, he dabbles with music. That doesn't work. So he starts dabbling with drugs. And even though it's a comedy, it's that thing of, you know, so many kids go that route. And, you know, they feel that they don't want to do a 9-to-5. Mm. And so that's where the idea came from. That
Because he's seduced by the idea, because he sees other people making a sense of music, and he mentions, oh, So Solid and all that, and you've actually even got Ashley Waters doing a little cameo in your film. And then he sees people dealing drugs and making rich, so he thinks he can knock out a little bit of grass or something, but he's very small time.
He's very small time, and I think that's the problem with young children at the moment. I mean, I go to so many talks and with young people, and there's kind of an idea in a lot of young people's minds that they need to be respected, and they don't know where that respect's going to come from. Mm-hmm. And I try and tell young people, you know, find a craft and learn it, master it, because that's the only way you can really get to that level. But I think many young people are in a bit of a rush to, you know, to make
and
money.
And they think that they're due this.
Yeah, no, in a sense, and you have, you've got to work for that. And that's the kind of message I kind of wanted to get out there, that you can't rush these things. And so even though it's a comedy, I think there's a very strong message in the film, that, you know, be yourself. But then at the same time, you know, I think young people now, I think they just want to see good films. And I think we've got to stop trying to always make movies for a social message. I think the social message will come from just a good film.
Yeah, well, I think also if yours is funny, which it is, I think in a way laughter can sort of say a bit more.
I think so, yeah. I think you can really get into young people's minds with comedy, because you're not preaching to them. It's got to be done in a way where they don't feel like they're getting spoken to. There's a lot of things going on in London was not good. You know, kids are dying on the streets, and, you know, knife crimes are at an all-time high. And I think sometimes you just need to escape from that. I think these kids out there, they don't want to just see their own lives on TV and film all the time. I think they need to go to the cinema and come out of that world and actually...
Yeah, and yet your film, which has all of this sort of lurking in the background, there are guns. There is a gun thrown into it, like there was in Bullet Boy, that's sort of hidden in a plastic bag. But it doesn't become a main prop. It doesn't become a kind of main crux that there's life depends on this gun. In a way, your film shows these people having sort of fun, in a way. It is fun. Well, they're knocking out illegal DVDs and selling drugs, but they have a sort of lightness of attitude towards their existence.
You know what? The main message I wanted to get out there is, I mean, I've lived in a London council estate all my life, and it's not all doom and gloom. It's not. And even though the media would love to kind of paint that picture that every young person with a hood, you know, is going to stab someone, and, well, actually, they're not. And some of these kids are just like Kenneth. They're just, you know, they might talk with this kind of talk, and they might have a hoodie on, but actually, they're not built for that. And it's just a bravado that, you know, it's an image thing. Kenneth, you know, he sees the gun, and that's not for him. It's a bit too far. Yeah. He knows that's not something that he wants to touch, even though he gives it a big talk all the time.
He's a sweet boy. He goes home and his mum's Linda Robson off the telly.
Yeah.
Perry Benson.
Oh, Linda's brilliant, I must say.
But, you know, they're all good. All your characters are good. You've got some very nice cameos in there. You've got him, you've got Linda, you've got Perry Benson, you've got Terry Stone doing a debt collecting man, you've got Ashley Waters, you've got Jamie Winston in there. You got them all together.
We were blessed with cast, you know. And I think when I asked the cast why they, you know, came on board, one of the main things was really the script, the fact that it was different and it had that messaging. I remember talking to Linda, and she feels very strongly about, you know, these issues, knife crime and what's going on out there. And for her, she saw that message in there that actually, you know, Kenneth's family, they're not your typical family that, you know, dad's left the house and it's just a single mum. Actually, they're a loving family, and this kid's just around all this madness, and he's... it's turned him a little crazy. And I think...
and he's got a little sister as well.
Yep.
And a hamster.
Yep, he's got a little sister, a hamster.
Who doesn't even like him.
No one likes him. And I think that's the problem. That's the real message out there, that, you know, what you give out is what you get back.
Tell me a bit about the filming of it, because, I mean, anyone that's been to West London will sort of recognise a lot of spots there. Where did you film, and did you go many places? You seemed to be in one estate, basically.
Yeah, we filmed on a council estate in Ladbroke Grove, and it was weird because this was the first urban film that was all set in a council estate where, you know, normally, I'm normally part of these kind of street films, and you might go to a location for maybe 2 days and then move on. Whereas with this film, it was all, we were there for 3.5 weeks. So we knew we needed the support of the people. And at the start of it, I think residents were a bit unsure, you know, are we going to let this film crew come in and take over our estate? And what their main concern was that, is this another film about a kid with a gun? Because we don't want that here. Like, we don't want our home painted in that light. And they did. They all come round to it, and we had their full backing. And a lot of them were extras in the film.
Yeah, and some of it's very, very colourful as well. Really exciting.
I wanted to paint that picture of the Goonbred estate having so many characters. You know, anyone that lives on a council estate will tell you, you know, they'll know the guy next door that never turns his music down. They'll know the, you know, the... There's so many characters.
Well, you know, the old ladies and the kids. So
that's it. And what I really wanted to paint is that it isn't just black people, it isn't just white people. You've got so many different cultures living on a council estate. And I tried to, you know, make fun of all the cultures. I didn't want to leave one out.
How do you know what you were doing? I mean, I know you've grown up in telly and you've done The Bill and Casualty and all that, like, because you've been here in the UK working since you were 12 years old?
12 years old, yeah.
So how did you suddenly think, well, I can go and do a crane shot in a council estate and kind of get this mix of characters? How do you know what you did?
Do you know what it was? It sounds mad, but it was always in my head. And the challenge was persuading other people that I knew what I was doing. That was the challenge. As in, I guess, I've been around so many directors, over the years, you know, you can tell a good director and you can tell a bad director. You can tell a director that doesn't know what he's doing and kind of lets the actors just do everything themselves because they don't know what to do. And you can tell a director that really knows exactly how he wants his film. And I think that's the directors I love working with, because it's their vision. Me and Michael initially wrote the script. I knew that obviously we had the script and I knew I was going to play Kenneth. But the directing thing was more of a bit of a pipe dream. It was more, you know, I'd love to do it, but who's going to let me do it? And I remember Michael saying, bruv, no one's going to, you know, who's going to let you direct it at this age? And so I thought, on a cheeky one, when I went to the first meeting for the film, I thought I'd just pitch it to them and say, look, because the more I thought about it, it was like, well, who else is going to direct this? I've got it all in my head. I had the crane shots in my head when we were writing the film. And so I had it all planned out, and it was just a case of Revolver having the faith, and luckily they did, and it went from there.
Yeah, but, well, it's very funny and it's got a lot of energy. You've got some lovely music in there as well. You've got Dizzy Rascal and Lily Allen, and you've got Tiny Temper. There's everyone on there, which is good.
Yeah,
I think it's very exciting. Personally, I'm very excited that you could come on Phil Wheatley and talk about it as well. We do Eric Roma, but we also do Another Hood, and it thrilled me as well. I thought it was a really interesting film, and I love the language of it as well. But Adam Deacon, congratulations on that.
Thank you. Cheers.
That is all for Film Weekly this week. The music we've been featuring on the podcast has been from Ben Debilili and their number one album, Très Très Fort. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday for my Trailer Trash column and the best film news and reviews. We'll be back next week with a Film Weekly French special, But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Lucy Greenwell, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.